All right, then. Well, how are you? Friday, 5 p.m. Another week ends, and we are once again live in the studio. Got to get used to this. The situation of being back here at WHPC, it's awesome. After doing this for about a quarter of a century,
them both in equal measure.
What, doing them from home as much as doing them here?
Yeah, I did.
I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed doing them at home, but I have to admit it felt a little bit cloistered. It just seems like this
you
is more like the way it
the
should be.
Studio atmosphere.
Well, here's the truth. We've been doing this series on How Music Changed, based on Duke Ellington, for a full half year now. So every show, except for the past two, have been recorded from our house, you know, basically constructed from home due to the pandemic. But now that we have now the school is open and we're back here, it's just like, you know, it feels great. It feels liberating. Now that I've mentioned it, we have recorded 24 shows to the music of Duke Ellington. If ever anybody deserved it, it is Duke. We did something similar with Louis Armstrong. He deserved it as well. But if you're going to name some of the most important artists of the 20th century, I think both of those names would come to mind immediately from me, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, for a variety of different reasons. What makes Duke so special, in my mind, is that he never stopped trying to be a creative person. He didn't ever say, I could just do the same show.
Yeah, we just coast.
Do the style that I have. This is my style. This is what I do. Duke was constantly reinventing himself. Now, imagine the difficulties in being almost universally recognized as one of the most creative musicians on the planet, while simultaneously being underappreciated because the public sees you as an anachronism. Everybody thinks that you're old school, or you're too old to be part of what's happening now. You're not hip enough to be playing in the age of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Ellington faced the scenario, and yet he absolutely refused to yield to nostalgia or to play into the hands of record company executives who wanted to manipulate him. He was staunchly independent, and his creativity flowed whether there was an audience for it or not. Sales of his music in the 60s were slow, but time had proven that Ellington's unyielding creativity resulted in music that withstood the test of time. Of all the artists and musicians who were famous in the 30s, 40s, etc., Ellington stands as perhaps the only one to maintain his artistic focus and his probing sense of curiosity into the 70s, constantly discovering and writing new music until he ran out of road. We played a track last week from Ellington's album dedicated to when he was traveling around the world. And there's one other that we didn't get to that I want to add to this. This is from his Far East Suite album. This song is called Mount Harissa on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you.
joint and stretch out. That's one of the best things about his tracks from the 60s is that he wasn't limited anymore to the 78 RPM, and he was able to breathe a little bit. Now, we've played some tracks from his first Sacred concert last week. Now it's the second Sacred concert. I want to talk about this confluence of jazz and the church. And there's some interesting reading here from the book that was written by Harvey Cohen called Duke Ellington's America. I'm going to read that to you if you don't mind. Reverend Dr. John G. Gensel, pastor of the Advent Lutheran Church on Upper Broadway in New York City, made the jazz constituency a central component of his ministerial work beginning in the early 60s. One night between sets, one of the musicians asked to talk with him, Gensel said in 65. I realized that there was an open field here. I began to think a lot about this whole jazz world, and I realized there was a lot of pastor work that could be done, that there was a need, and wherever there's a need for the church of JC to do something about it. So Gensel found fame within jazz circles for hitting the jazz clubs several times a week, making it a point to stop in at the rattier as well as the ritzier venues. Soon, many of the musicians, including Charles Mingus and Max Roach, began bringing their problems to him and showing up at his church, both to perform and to worship. Ellington admires Gensel's commitment to jazz and its players, famous and obscure, and felt particularly impressed by Gensel's lack of hesitation in assuming the appropriateness of jazz as a means of worship. Quote, Pastor Gensel often went without, denying the needs of his own family and even using money earned by his beautiful wife as a schoolteacher in order to pay the rent or doctor's bills or to buy food for some of the less fortunate night people. Ellington recalled in his autobiography, Ellington's sister Ruth regularly attended Gensel services, and she and her brother donated one of Ellington's pianos, on which many of his famous compositions were written, to the church. He officiated at the last rites of John Coltrane and Ellington's partner, Billy Strayhorn, even, among other jazzmen. His mission continued until the end of his life in the 70s, despite many scathing letters sent to him accusing him of, quote, serving Satan and, quote, corrupting religion. His defense against them was grounded in the New Testament and the changing cultural conditions that he and other religious leaders faced in the 1960s. This is his quote. Our Savior himself did not hesitate to mingle with all types of persons. He preached and taught outside the temple. Today, it is especially important that religion should not be confined within the walls of churches and synagogues. If people will not come to priests, the ministers, or the rabbis, they should go to the people wherever they are. Ellington's second Sacred concert had a track that was dedicated to Gensel. Now, think about this, though. In a poll taken during the 1960s, only one out of five over 2,000 black preachers surveyed across the country approved of jazz or blues being used in worship services. Just 6.5% of rural preachers in the same survey approved of it, and over 90% of them expressed strict disapproval of the idea. Ellington, however, said, he described it, at first I was taken aback. God, religion, it's a personal thing with me, not to be mixed with a theatrical performance, but I thought about it and wanted to give my best to God. Here's a track from the second Sacred concert called Heaven on American Net Radio 90.3 WHBC. Heaven, Now, as you listen to these tracks from the Second Sacred Concert, you've got to imagine the surroundings. I mean, here, again, from Harvey G. Cohen's book. On November 19, 1965, Dr. Bryant M. Kirkland, minister of the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City, announced the next sacred concert, the second, to be held at his church on December 26. As in San Francisco, that's where the first one was held, the press release announcing the sacred concert featured some preemptive spin control on the potential controversies surrounding the use of popular music in a religious setting. The Fifth Avenue Sacred Concert and the corresponding CBS TV special that filmed it, that resulted from it, inspired more comment across the country than the initial concert at the Grace Cathedral. Most reviews within New York were positive, as were syndicated wire service reports, two of which mentioned the smartly gowned, fur-clad socialites in attendance. A reviewer in a New Jersey paper called it, quote, one of the most moving confessions of faith I've ever heard. New York Herald Tribune delivered the most positive verdict among the major New York critics, and the view that best captured Ellington's intentions. Here's their quote. In a sense, there was nothing truly liturgical about his music. In another sense, it was totally liturgical. His music, at its best, is a powerful distillation of emotion and emotional gesture. It speaks, whether through a singer, a piano, a solo saxophone, or even a set of drums, of tremendously personal things. As such, it is never removed from the purest meaning of prayer. One of the tracks that they noted where the crowd would often bow their heads during Ellington's piano solo was a track called Meditation. So we'll play that into one of the more unusual tracks from the second concert called The Biggest and Busiest Intersection, back-to-back on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. The great Louis Belson on drums playing with Duke Ellington. Imagine that in a church, huh?
Oh, wow.
Something else. Those are all from the Second Sacred Concert. Now, at the same time that jazz was experiencing commercial decline in the 60s, a simultaneous rise in support and respect for the music within academic and high culture circles occurred, starting in the mid-60s. As the music went down, respect went up, oddly. The 20s vision of jazz as an immoral influence had faded, if not entirely vanished, from the scene. The myth of jazz musicians possessing only primitive, innate talent was gone, replaced by the realization that many jazz performers were among perhaps the most significant artists America had ever produced during the 20th century, if not the most significant. Ellington, of course, had placed himself at the center of these efforts to break down such prejudices for decades. Consequently,
He received more awards, honors, and honorary degrees than any other jazz figure during his last decade. One of them was the Grammy Award for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album in 1968. The reason for the album was actually somber. His writing partner, his right arm, his mind, his brain, the person that helped make him work, Billy Strayhorn, passed away from cancer in 1967. So Ellington decided to make an album consisting entirely of songs that were written by Billy Strayhorn. And he called the album His Mother Called Him Bill. And it's one of the most interesting albums that Ellington recorded, especially in this point of his career. Most of the rest of the show is going to be dedicated to this album. And here's a track from His Mother Called Him Bill called Buddha on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHPC. What you're hearing there is Ellington trying to convey the celebratory love that he had for Billy Strayhorn on a track like that. But it wasn't easy for him at all. Again, from Cohen's book, Ellington stepped up his already hectic writing regimen after Billy Strayhorn died from cancer on May 31st, 1967. Ellington, by all reports, was devastated by the death of Strayhorn, the man he referred to as, quote, his favorite human being, as well as, quote, my right arm, my left arm, all the eyes in the back of my head, my brain waves in his head and his in mine. During the last weeks, Ellington did not visit, unable to bear seeing his friend in the last throes of cancer, but spoke with him daily on the phone, sent numerous packages to him, and paid for several pianists in Paris to record sessions especially for Strayhorn, which were played at his bedside. According to Marion Logan, when the news of Strayhorn's death came, Ellington cried for hours, and when asked by her husband, Dr. Logan, if he was going to be all right, Ellington replied, expletive no. I'm not going to be all right. Nothing is all right now.
Oh, that's so sad.
Ellington chose not to attend Strayhorn's viewing on the private service for him and stayed instead with the band in Reno. Though he flew to New York City for the public funeral and wrote a eulogy for Strayhorn, he might have missed the funeral if Dr. Logan had not goaded the upset Ellington out of bed that morning. In his autobiography, Ellington wrote that, quote, many people are indebted to Billy Strayhorn, and I more than anybody. In the weeks after Strayhorn's death, Ellington slept far more than usual, produced less music, and Dr. Logan pronounced Ellington depressed. It was a big blow to the old man, remembered Mercer Ellington. In terms of his work and personal life, things would now become more difficult for Ellington, but he rose to the challenge. When Strayhorn passed, Ellington was in the midst of various projects, and realizing that he did not have Strayhorn at his side, he found that in order to cover the same ground that he had been covering, he had to work harder, according to his son Mercer. If anything, Strayhorn's passing stimulated Ellington's ability to write more music than he'd ever had to before. Now, since this album, and his mother called him Bill, is dedicated to the songs written by Billy Strayhorn, one of them were moving tracks, is a song that he wrote entitled directly because of what he was going through with doctors fighting cancer. This song is called Blood Count on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Thank you.
So moving. For the rest of his life, Ellington acknowledged the influence of Strayhorn from the bandstand almost every night. Strayhorn songs did not disappear from the band's repertoire. Ellington closed dozens, if not hundreds, of shows in his last years with an emotional solo piano version of Strayhorn's tune, Lotus Blossom, in tribute to Strayhorn. His best-known pieces were not recorded for the session, and his mother called him Bill. Songs like Take the A-Train and Chelsea Bridge are not on this album. Instead, the tracks seemed more like Ellington's personal favorites, some obscure, many of them swinging, and all of them filled with Strayhorn's pungent gift of melody. Few of the songs reflect the sadness and tragedy surrounding Strayhorn's demise, except for one of Strayhorn's last compositions, The Haunting Blood Count, seemingly inspired by his time in the hospital, and one of his most memorable pieces, the track that we had just heard, is Blood Count. Here's one of the others, a bit of a more upbeat piece, what Ellington was going to express his life, a song called Rain Check on Americanet Radio, 90.3 WHPC.
Thank you.
Wow. Ellington definitely trying to bring out what he considered to be the best elements of Billy Strayhorn as a songwriter with that track called Rain Check. Now, when the album was recorded in a few different sessions, and it felt as though there was something very important about it as they were doing it, because there was a great deal of love for Billy Strayhorn, not only by Duke Ellington, but by the band members themselves, who, of course, had gotten to know him incredibly well. And when the sessions were done, everybody was packing up to leave, more or less somber, I suppose, quiet. And as the story goes, it was decided by somebody in the control room to keep the mic on when the tape deck was running. And as everybody was walking out of the room, Duke Ellington walked over to the piano and he sat down and he started to play Lotus Blossom, which is the song that he ended many of his shows with after Billy Strayhorn died. This is probably the reason why he did that, because he did it at the recording sessions. And it's really just a spontaneous moment for Ellington to just bring this out and to perform this beautiful piece as written by Billy Strayhorn, as I said, entitled Lotus Blossom, on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHBC. Isn't that incredible and beautiful?
It's hard to fathom how much music that man must have had in his head.
Right. Everybody's walking. You can hear the noise in the background as they're packing up and getting ready to leave, and he's just kicks that out.
Yep.
With perfection. It's amazing.
Amazing.
We've got time for just one more, and an album that followed this was an interesting pairing of Francis A. and Edward K., as the album was called. Of course, Francis Albert Sinatra and Edward Kennedy Ellington teamed up. And here's one track from that album called I Like the Sunrise. We'll leave you with this, folks. Hope you enjoyed the show. I particularly enjoyed this one. I'll see you next Friday as we wrap it up on Americanet Radio 90.3 WHBC.
I like the sunrise, 'cause it brings a new day. I like a new day, it brings new hope, they say. I like the sunrise, blazing in the new sky. Nighttime is weary, oh, and so am I. Every evening I wish upon a star that my brand new bright tomorrow isn't very far. When that heavy blue curtain of night is raised up high, out of sight, I like the sunrise, so heavenly to I like the sunrise, I hope it likes for me. Wish upon a star that my brand new bright tomorrow isn't very far. When that heavy blue curtain of night is raised up high, way out of sight, I like the sunrise. sunrise.